That's a really good question. Obviously, glycogen depletion is likely to occur around 70 minutes of like high intensity football actions. So essentially the petrol tanks in your muscle will deplete at that point and then they'll start to experience fatigue. So just making the coaches aware that these players are fasting, if we can adapt their training in any way, that's probably the starting point.
Welcome to the Performance Nutrition Podcast, giving you the latest evidence-based research and cutting-edge insights for elite mental and physical performance. He's connecting you directly with the world's leading experts and coaches. Here's your host, Dr. Bubs.
Welcome back, or welcome to the Performance Nutrition Podcast. This is season number 7, episode number 5, and today I have the pleasure of connecting with Matt Jones, performance nutritionist for West Ham United of the English Premier League. Matt also has a wealth of experience over the last 10 years working as the Director of Nutrition at the University of Oregon, working with the pro football club Clube de Regatas de Flamengo in Brazil, as well as with the Saudi Arabian Football Federation and the Armed Forces in the United Arab Emirates, which leads into today's conversation all about Ramadan and how to fuel athletes during the holy month of fasting. In this episode, we'll discuss how to avoid or limit dehydration, the impacts of glycogen depletion on athletes, as well as the inadequate intake of protein. How does lower energy or carbohydrate fueling during Ramadan impact an athlete? Changes in training and competition nutrition, as well as supplements, including the potential use of caffeine during Ramadan. Before we get started, though, a quick heads up. Athlete Performance Nutrition will be hosting the second annual Football Performance Nutrition Summit this June 13th to 15th, 2023. Learn from leading experts in performance nutrition working in the NFL and NCAA, such as Kate Calloway, Director of Performance Nutrition for the Carolina Panthers, John Parenti, Director of Nutrition for the Miami Dolphins, and many, many more to be added to the list. Join us this June and register for free for the Football Performance Nutrition Summit 2.0. That's right, register for free for FPN 2.0 by signing up at athleteperformancenutrition.com/summits. That's with an S. athleteperformancenutrition.com/summits, and you'll be the first to hear about this year's all-star lineup and all the details. All right, let's do this, my conversation with Matt Jones. Matt, thanks so much for carving out some time today for us.
No problem, Mark. It's great to finally connect with you. We've been trying for some time to arrange this. So sorry on my heart, on my behalf for missing you so many times, but it's great to finally connect.
No worries at all. Listen, it's always challenging when schedules are hectic. And like we were just talking about offline, when teams are performing better or worse also influences how everything's going. So definitely appreciate you coming on and looking forward to talking, you know, about Ramadan. Obviously, we're in the period right now, something that more and more athletes or practitioners with athletes are thinking about how they might be changing their nutrition in response to that. And of course, looking forward to picking your brain on working in football in your career. So, you know, if we start with Ramadan, obviously, you know, the Islamic religion, we're talking about 28 or 30 days of not eating and drinking during daylight hours. And classically in North American sports, you know, athletes like Hakeem Olajuwon in basketball and Kyrie Irving today, you know, practicing Ramadan. And so as a performance nutritionist, what are some of the things you're thinking about right off the top of your head when an athlete, you know, is going to be going into this this period of fasting in the day?
Yeah, well, I think first things first, like assessing the contextual factors around Ramadan, because I think with nutrition, context is so important. Particularly with Ramadan, because obviously Ramadan can change considerably depending on your geographical location. It's like where you are in the world, the season, the climatic season.
Yeah, it's going with the loot, just so people, if they're not familiar, it goes with the lunar calendar and not with the traditional calendar. And so going back to the Olympics in 2012, I believe it was in the summertime, and obviously now we're in March and April, so it's moving around in the calendar, which adds a layer, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And not only that, the community that you like live within can also like influence your experiences with Ramadan. So I've experienced Ramadan in a Muslim majority community and also a Muslim minority community. So it's completely different, and it's quite interesting to see. So obviously in a Muslim majority community, like the whole society kind of shifts to support like people adhering, yeah, practicing Ramadan. So restaurants will close during the day. Work hours will change, training times will change, the competitive schedule. So kickoff times will typically change with football, for instance, to later in the day.
And so that's the ideal setting, obviously, when absolutely, the environment can help dictate the choices and everything else. I mean, this would be the ideal situation, right? But as you're alluding to here in a North American or European setting, it's not the case.
Exactly. So when you're in the Muslim minority kind of society, then you don't have that luxury, really, and it can be quite challenging to manage that. And as I said, the fast can vary depending on your location, from anywhere between 20 hours during summer months in like Northern Europe to right now, I think it's around 15 or 16 hours here in the UK. But obviously, it changes throughout the course of the 30 days as well. The days are getting longer here. So obviously, sunset is going to occur later in the day. So there's a number of different contextual factors that kind of you have to take into account. But from a nutrition perspective, if you kind of like dial it back right down to the basic level, we often talk about the three T's within nutrition. So the total quantity of energy and nutrients, the type of nutrients, and then the timing of nutrients as well. Obviously, with Ramadan, you have to almost sacrifice the timing and just be mindful that there will be like potentially two or three opportunities to eat, which can pose a bit of a challenge in itself, because if you have elevated energy expenditures, like consuming 4,000 calories across two or three meals can be yes, quite tricky. But generally, if the athletes are able to maintain the other T's, so maintain the same type of foods and the total quantity of foods, then we typically see that they're able to manage their performance quite well during Ramadan itself. I mean, you only have to look last weekend. I think Morocco beat Brazil. Granted, it might have been a friendly game, but I would say 100% of those players will probably be fasting, if not adhering to Ramadan anyway. And so it just shows that players are able to, or athletes are able to maintain their performance. And that's kind of in line with most of the research as well. And most of these players will have developed their like coping mechanisms. Obviously they've been fasting from a young age. So it's probably not new to them. During, obviously it's a religious, it's the holy month. So they have that like psychological connection with their faith. And we can't kind of overlook that, really, because that's a spiritual element that can empower them and make them feel good. And that, in many ways, that can override the physiological elements that might impair them from time to time.
I was going to say, yeah, that motivation factor of just wanting to and really being willing to do this is such a big key in the whole story, right? Because if we were to impose this on an athlete, let's say for a different reason than it for a month, it obviously could be a very different response, and then impacts compliance and the rest of it. Now, if we start off with even things like hydration, this is something where if we're not even consuming fluids in the day, because I think the general population, when we think fasting, they think, well, I'm still going to drink water all day. And these days, if someone's fasting, they'll still drink some coffee or some tea or these other things. But that's not the case with Ramadan. So how do you think about that hydration piece?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most challenging element, to be honest. And I personally have done a Ramadan fast once. so I've experienced it. And that was the most challenging element, just not being able to drink. Like, you constantly have that drive, that desire to more thirst mechanism, of course. And that was the most challenging element. So obviously you have those opportunities before or during dawn, before the suhoor meal and then iftar meal. So again, going back to the total quantity of fluids, if you think like 1 milliliter per calorie, so that's perhaps the gold standard recommendation right now for fluid requirements. One of our players, perhaps around 3.5 liters of fluid a day, 3,500 calories a day. So they'd have to split that across three meals or those hours that they're allowed to consume food. Ideally, like prior to sun rising, so the sahur meal, consuming around 600 mil to 1,000 or 1 liter of fluid. Ideally, not drinking like rapidly, and perhaps obviously they're going to consume that with some fluid as well, with a meal. So it's going to slow down digestion and promote the absorption of that fluid, of course. So things like
and Matt, just to pause there for a minute, a question I get from athletes who are practicing Ramadan is around getting up in the morning, this idea of getting up even earlier to consume either, like you say, the fluid and then allow time for the meal. Obviously, the daylight, like you mentioned, is changing depending on where you are in the world. So that is a factor there. But is there a general rule you have in terms of athletes kind of getting up even earlier than they normally would?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I would always encourage an athlete to wake up. Like honestly, when I was in the Middle East, many of the athletes there adopted the party all night, sleep all day approach, like the nocturnal approach. So
they university studying for exams approach.
Yeah, they essentially obviously this is certainly not optimal, but they pretty much stayed awake all evening. So from iftar, it like 8 p.m. right the way through till 4 a.m. They were awake with their family, celebrating, eating, drinking, reading the Quran, and then they'd go back to bed like pretty much all day, and then they train in the evening and repeat that process. But it, obviously in Muslim minority countries like the UK and US, that's not always possible. So I would typically encourage the athletes that I work with to wake up just before sunrise. So here in the UK, that's around 4:30. And then they would pray and then consume a meal, and then the fast would begin. Obviously, you have to appreciate that sleep will be impaired and interrupted in some way. So considering the timing of caffeine at that point, whether you want to go back to sleep or whether you want to kind of continue with your day, that can kind of inform those decisions around caffeine. But yeah, going back to hydration, obviously taking that opportunity to consume some fluids, again, ideally with that meal, is going to optimize the retention of the fluids. Milk is a great option. Perhaps targeting somewhere between 600 and like 1 liter, 600 mil and 1 liter. Sorry for the US people, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's all good. But that, yeah, it works.
Like 16 ounces is 500 mil, is that right?
Yeah.
Honestly, that was the hardest part of working in America, like the whole conversion thing.
Yeah, no, 100%.
Yeah, and then the remaining requirement in those hours after iftar, so like after the sun sets, essentially.
And as you mentioned there, just circling back, you mentioned on the caffeine front. So if you're staying up, if you're in a Muslim majority country, you're staying up all night, and typically you wake up in the morning and you have your coffee. Well, this is now you stayed up all night, so not necessarily chasing that caffeine at 4:30 in the morning before you might be actually going to bed for 7 or 8 hours, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So like you have to kind of take into consideration those contextual factors on sleep and things like that. So it's always difficult to make like specific recommendations
for,
because
sure,
everyone's, yeah, context is different.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're planning or hoping to go back to bed, then and go to bed for an extended period of time, then perhaps consuming caffeine is not such a great idea. But there's also some nice evidence around like caffeine naps and things. So if you were to consume some caffeine prior to sleep and then go back to bed for maybe 30 to 60 minutes, that might have a beneficial effect on your performance, your cognitive performance when you wake up. So that could be around like 7-8 o'clock in the morning, and then you kind of go about your normal day. So there could be some benefits there. But again, if you're planning to go back to bed for an extended period, it might not be a great idea.
Yeah, I was going to flip it there for you and talk about the, you know, if you were in London or New York or Toronto and you had to get up and go to work, you know, perhaps that sort of caffeine in the morning and then a nap in the afternoon or midday, trying to get a little bit of rest in there. You know, are there some strategies that you've used in the past whether it's athletes or even general public on that front, like obviously coaches and performance staff having to do this as well?
Yeah, well, pretty much exactly as you just said. So trying to like have that caffeine nap. So wake up, have the sahur meal, try and consume some carbohydrates and protein, a relatively standard meal, if you like. And as I mentioned, 600 to a liter of fluids, and then some caffeine potentially, and then go back to bed for an hour perhaps, and then wake up and then kind of go about your day, and trying to find that opportunity in the afternoon to catch up on sleep. I think like your lifestyle during that day has to change slightly as well. You find yourself not really wanting to interact, because talking, it makes your mouth really dry. And at least that was my experiences anyway. It makes your mouth really dry, and you just find yourself like kind of wanting to hide away and not
podcast really. In the middle of the day, not ideal then.
Well,
during that time
right now, but and what else? You want to try and avoid like warm environments, so trying to stay in cool environments. But at the same time, you have to expose yourself to sunlight as well to kind of avoid any like issues with the circadian rhythm and all those kind of things. So so many layers of complexity, isn't
there? Yeah, 100%. I suppose that's one that would really come up, wouldn't it? It's obviously the sun's kind of queuing up a lot of these our circadian rhythms, and even as it relates to the gut, which anyone who's traveled east-west significant time zones realizes that, you know, you travel to the US from London and all of a sudden you're waking up at 3 a.m. to go to the bathroom because the gut patterns are dialed into the time zone where you've come from. And so I imagine with the light and dark part of this eating in the evening, which, you know, would you speculate, obviously athletes being healthy, being fit, being metabolically very healthy, probably much less of an impact than, let's say, if we had a staff or coach who's 30 or 40 pounds overweight and struggling with hypertension or things like that, that this could actually, you know, we might need some to really think about strategies, because it could lead to a lot of overfueling in those late hours. Curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you look at the research on like high performing athletes, I think it kind of suggests that most, if not all of them, are able to maintain their performance pretty well in almost all elements of performance. So aerobic, strength, power, speed, all elements really. And that impressive. Kind of like aligns with what we see like practically like within our athletes that are performing during Ramadan now, not just in like performance tests in the lab, for instance, they actually are able to perform pretty well. But as you say, I think like fasting for like an unhealthy individual, on one hand, it probably has some health benefits, like the metabolic benefits, like on blood glucose, blood lipids, there's probably some benefits. But at the same time, obviously, if you can't control your appetite, then like you break the fast, and you'll tend to find during Ramadan, obviously it's the holy month, it's like a celebration. So
yeah, so lots of food around, lots of, you know, desserts and the rest of it.
The types of foods change, lots of like higher calorie, highly palatable foods, high in fat, generally a reduction in fruit and vegetables. So yeah, I guess this that can be quite a that could have a negative impact on those individuals.
You know, you talk obviously carbohydrates and fruit, so glycogen depletion is another one that just would come to mind, you know, see for athletes in terms of this period, and whether it's training intensely, if you get into this, you know, for thinking of a North American calendar, even the EPL are coming to the end of season, so there's a lot of load and fatigue building up for the playoffs in North America. So on the glycogen side, you know, what are some of the strategies that you use, and how, you know, quote unquote, concerned would you be when you might go into, say, a compressed schedule and it's in the middle of Ramadan for an athlete?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And again, it's a huge challenge. But obviously, glycogen depletion is likely to occur around 70 minutes of like high intensity football actions. So essentially, the petrol tanks in your muscle will deplete at that point, and then they'll start to experience fatigue. So just making the coaches and like technical staff aware that these players are fasting. So if we can adapt their training in any way, that's probably the starting point. Because again, looking at the research, it kind of suggests that you might not want to do high intensity, like intermittent training within that fasting period. But again, you're not going to be able to train that individual alone like later in the day. So he's going to have to do it. But making coaches aware of that and making small modifications where possible. So being mindful of those glycogen stores and trying to consume the daily requirement for carbohydrate within those periods. So like 5 grams per kilo on a typical training day, somewhere around like 450 grams for our players, perhaps.
Okay.
And that can be quite challenging in itself. So
I was going to say, in terms of some of the hyper palatable foods or liquids and juices or various things, like there's some strategies that sort of lean on or timings of when the sun first falls, because it's two parts there. I mean, like you say, these athletes are used to it. They've been doing it year on year, so they probably have a bit of a pattern. Curious how that works for those evening hours.
Sure. So one thing that we try and encourage is like separating it into like two different mindsets, really. So the Suhoor meal before the sunrise, you're obviously trying to encourage players to consume foods that are going to digest quite slowly. So like slow fuels, if you like, refer to them. So like whole grains. But they also need to be quite quick to prepare. So like bran flake cereal, with some berries and some different fruits, perhaps, and a protein shake with some milk could be a practical, convenient way to achieve your protein requirement. But then later in the day, you probably want to try and encourage like faster fuels, if you like, so more refined carbohydrates, potentially like well-cooked spaghetti, fuels that are going to digest quite quickly and perhaps not
make you hungry again.
So foods that are less satiating, so like less potatoes and more like white pasta, white breads, those kind of things, because they're going to have to potentially consume multiple meals again in that evening period. So yeah, if you're eating like highly satiating foods, then you're less likely to be able to achieve those total requirements for the day. Also taking into consideration the cultural elements as well. So generally, Muslims will break the fast with dates and laban. Laban is like a yogurt type drink. And that's kind of like the typical practice. And that's even during games. So if like in the Premier League this year, they've decided to pause games to allow players to break the fast. So they will typically ask for dates, maybe not laban during the game, but dates definitely. Like a
great carbohydrate source, especially get those medjool dates.
The energy dense little things, aren't they? But obviously they have the fiber content, so maybe have to consider that.
Yeah, I was going to say, in terms of dessert choices, then if we're getting into that meal that's at sunset, talk about culturally, there's obviously higher fat desserts as well, but I assume that some of the higher carbohydrate desserts then as a way to hit that total would be something that you'd be leaning on. So I'm not sure if, in a Western setting, it might be more sorbets versus kind of higher fat ice cream, but how would it look in the...
Yeah, so from my experience, culturally, things like omali was consumed quite frequently. So omali is essentially... it's kind of like rice pudding, but a hybrid of rice pudding and like bread and butter pudding, so kind of like a hybrid of those things with some different like spices and dried like raisins and pistachio nuts sometimes as well on there. So that was a dessert that was like frequently consumed during Ramadan. Well, to be honest, all year round within those cultures, but particularly more during emphasis. Ramadan. And again, that's incredibly energy dense, high in calories, high in carbohydrate, also high in fat, depending on how you prepare it. But again, if you're working with a performance chef, then you could perhaps influence the recipe in a way.
For sure.
But yeah, utilizing those higher calorie, hyper palatable foods from time to time can be helpful in like meeting elevated energy requirements and elevated carbohydrate requirements as well.
Yeah, I could see how if you were in a Muslim majority country and you were up all night, you could be much easier to sort of hit some of these daily total targets because you've got a good 8 hours or so to be able to achieve it.
Yeah.
Imagine in a Muslim majority countries where you're still in the typical 9 to 5 and typical training schedule, probably gets a little trickier in terms of bedtime versus, getting up earlier in the morning. Is there any other, whether it's smoothies or liquid forms, that you sort of encourage in Muslim minority countries for guys to be able to get in? Because I imagine it's still a challenge, right?
Definitely. Yeah. So before they go to bed, then we probably encourage another, like another meal or snack of some kind. So if you imagine that they're consuming like one meal before sunrise, and then the iftar meal as soon as the sun sets, and then ideally another meal before they sleep. So that could be like 11 p.m. perhaps. So again, that's kind of like driven by the need to consume more calories and also like the need to stimulate muscle protein synthesis more than twice. So again, having that protein rich snack before sleep can be useful. And in many cases, that could just be a smoothie. Again, you can like load that full of calories as well if necessary. You can vary the energy density of that. Smoothie, whey protein, or casein protein, depending on which you prefer. Or if you mix whey with milk, then I tend to find that has a similar sort of effect, and yogurt as well. And some fruits, some nut butters, things like that. And then they could consume that before they go to bed to catch up on calories, but also catch up on the macronutrients and protein particularly.
Tremendous. And with struggling to kind of maintain, to achieve some of those carbohydrate totals or protein totals or energy totals, and if energy expenditure might be going up in certain parts of the year, you know, is there certain flags that you're looking for, how you might communicate with the S&C staff or the performance staff, you know, to see if players might be running sort of hot in terms of their outputs, and then what might you be thinking then, and how you attack all this?
Yeah, I guess in the most simple aspect, it was just measuring body weight, monitoring body weight daily. And looking for like deviations and changes in body mass. Obviously you continue to do skin fall assessments, like whether you do this every other week or however frequently you like to do them. And then obviously, taking into account the GPS data and obviously realizing that they're sedent within their day-to-day life, they'll probably become more sedentary. So even if the intensity and duration of training goes up slightly, the energy expenditure within like daily life might reduce slightly, so that may counterbalance. Always being in contact with both the performance staff to like get the data about GPS and the demands and volume of training, but then also the player about his lifestyle away from the training ground. And I think that one of Dr. Wheeler, he's the head of, or sorry, the doctor at West Ham United, he did some nice research a few years ago, looking at the lifestyle of football players, and he actually found that they are more sedentary than we actually think they are. They go home and play the PlayStation. So,
yeah. When they rest, and when they're training, they train hard, right?
Yeah, they're pretty good at conserving energy away from the training ground.
Tremendous. And if we quickly circle back, you talked about how the players break the fast, maybe mid-game with things like dates. If we think of the end of a game, trying to get fuel in them, I imagine we're trying to get that in and out, you know, to get through the gut as quick as we can so that they can feel hungry again to have that sort of dinner meal. Are there certain snacks or the way that you might build a shake or things like that that come into play there?
Yeah, honestly, it probably wouldn't differ too much to like the normal post-match meal, because we probably try and encourage that with most players.
For everybody.
For most. So like immediately after the game, we'd probably go with like a carbohydrate heavy drink. So trying to like restore glycogen as quickly as possible and rehydrate as well. That depends on the preference of the player, really. We let preference dictate practice within many of those decisions. So favoring carbohydrate there. So it could be like a fruit smoothie. And then we try like around 30 minutes after that, we provide them with some food. And that sushi is pretty popular typically. Like sandwiches, wraps, pizza.
Handheld things are easy to kind of eat while you're getting changed and
exactly,
in the locker room.
Yeah. And obviously the post-match period is influenced by so many factors, again, contextual factors, whether you've won the game, lost the game, referee made a bad decision, you made a bad decision, it can influence your appetite in many ways. So I think that's a huge challenge in itself, like outside of Ramadan, is actually getting players to kind of objectively focus on the next game and just like the next priority, which is recovery, rather than being lost in what's just happened.
Great point, because the performance nutritionist or sport dietitian is so focused on what's correct in that post-game period and trying to achieve that. And of course, as you're saying, the athlete in their mind have just come off the court or the pitch and they've just lost a game and there's all these things happening, and it's not always their first priority. And so marrying up those two things of how you can nudge them to achieve what you want is not always straightforward, is it?
It's so challenging. That's probably, like, as a young sports nutritionist, you quickly realize that's the hardest part of the job, I guess. There'll oftentimes be like protein shakers thrown around the changing rooms. I'm not drinking that, all these kind of things. Yeah. So developing those relationships with players and encouraging them. And it all stems from the relationships, really, doesn't it?
Hey friends, I hope you're enjoying this episode. A quick reminder, if you want to stay up to date on when each episode of the Performance Nutrition Podcast drops and receive evidence-based insights every month, then join the Athlete Performance Nutrition community by signing up to our newsletter. Head over to athleteperformancenutrition.com and sign up in the big black box. All right, let's get back to the conversation.
Tremendous. Anything else around, I guess we talked about caffeine supplements. Any other changes in the supplement front or in terms of timing of caffeine? Is that an opportunity where, again, in mid-game, might a player use that as a strategy as they get towards the back end of a game?
For sure, yeah. So the game itself, so I guess there's some things to talk about there, because in certain cases, players will ask for an exemption to consume food on the day of a game. But in other circumstances, so they'll go to the local imam and they'll get an exemption, but they'll have to make up that fasting day at the end of Ramadan, so they'll still have to do it at some
tag it on at the end.
Exactly. Yeah. But then in other cases, the players will actually fast throughout the entire game day. And again, looking at the available research, we know that carbohydrate loading prior to a game can be beneficial to maximize those glycogen stores. And if they're not able to do that, then what impact does that have on performance? At least in the short term, across those 30 days, it probably not going to have a huge impact, but during the game itself, players will either be consuming food if they have received that exemption, or they will have to break the fast mid-game, whatever time that falls, or to be honest, there are certain circumstances like earlier kickoffs, like 3 p.m. kickoff or midday kickoff, where they'll be fasting for the whole game. But as I said, this year, the Premier League will pause games, in the evening games, to allow players to break the fast. And the players that I've worked with, they will typically select to break the fast initially with a date or two dates, perhaps the Majul dates, as we mentioned. And then, encouraging them to consume around 30 grams of carbohydrate, or maybe 40 grams. So you're probably getting 20 grams from the dates, perhaps, and then a sports drink as well to provide fluid and electrolytes and more carbohydrate. You could perhaps encourage them to have a caffeine gum as well, depending on whether the medical department allow your players to play with gum, of course. So that could be another consideration as well during the game.
Yeah, it's interesting. The timing of the games, and again, I imagine mindset plays a big part of that of some athletes. Again, historically, I think back to basketball always, and Hakeem Olajuwon, it was a similar time of year, and but people were raising a lot of concerns, and he was having one of the greatest playoff runs of his career during that stretch. And so it is pretty impressive what one can do once they're just motivated to be able to achieve it.
And
I was going to say, I guess the flip side of that coin would be just how glycogen, if it's acting as a training regulator, and oftentimes we're sort of trying to get more of these periods where we're depleting muscle or liver glycogen and trying to get into some of these positions. Ramadan seems sort of a strategy to be able to achieve some of this with athletes. So they are training more with this depleted state. So I'd be curious, even your thoughts on, after Ramadan, any sort of super compensation or any, how players sort of feel coming out of it compared to just your typical player. Does it balance out? Do they actually feel a bigger lift when they come out the back end of Ramadan?
I guess so. I don't have any objective data to support that.
For sure, yeah.
Subjectively, after the holy month, they also have the period after Ramadan. I've forgotten the name of it now, which is annoying. But again, it's another celebration with family. Oh, that's going to really annoy. Eid. So again, it's another celebration. It's like the equivalent of our Christmas, if you like. And that's a period of time where they again like come together as a family and celebrate. And it's a big part of the Muslim calendar. So that will like spiritually bring lots of energy and emotion. So yeah, they can certainly feel good after that. And I think the point you touched on there about like modifying like mitochondrial biogenesis and those kind of things with with those like training low kind of things can be beneficial if you're able to like control the training. So if you're working with individual athletes, that can be possible. Or if you're in the Muslim majority countries, that can be possible, having those like aerobic sessions in the morning, fasting, allowing like glycogen to remain pretty low, and then having those like the strength based session, if you like, after the first meal, after the iftar, that could be beneficial. And again, looking at those mechanistic research around mitochondrial biogenesis and the enzymatic changes that occur there, whether that actually translates into a improved performance, I think we're a little bit unsure on that, aren't we, right now? But
awesome, Matt. If we pivot a little bit to your work in professional football, you know, curious how much, you know, blood testing and various biomarkers are informing your practice these days.
Oh, massively so. Yeah, it's very rare for us to get like solid objective data to support what we're doing and also inform decisions. It's challenging, isn't it, at that time? So biomarker testing, to be honest, like obviously you have like saliva, urine, blood, the fingertip blood samples that are now available, like the over-the-counter ones, that like the validity and reliability is looking quite solid of those things. And then traditional like venous blood samples. We do them like regularly throughout the season, like three or four times per season. Again, it really great way to inform decisions around the diet and fueling and all those things. Yeah.
How do you find, two questions there. One of them, how do you find the players' compliance or sort of attitude with the multiple blood draws? Is it sort of baked into the cake of guys what you do and it's just accepted? Or do new players coming in from different environments, you know, if it was different there, how do they feel about it? And then the second part would just be which biomarkers have you found, you know, most variability or most change that are impacting, you know, what you might do?
Yeah. The players' responses, I think that's very, very, very different. I haven't heard anyone complain, to be honest, about having it. As long as you like tell them the results and like inform them of the significance and importance of the results, I think they're always going to appreciate and value those things. I think if you just took some blood from them and like didn't ever tell them why, they'd probably be a little bit concerned.
And are you using more of the pinprick test then, or the actual venous samples for when they do those multiple draws?
Yeah, I mix it both. Like vitamin D in the last couple of years, we've measured with the fingertip sample. Again, because it's pretty easy and convenient. And you could do it more frequently, typically. They're quite accessible now. And again, the validity and reliability is like looking pretty good. So
100%.
You obviously have to question those things. But yeah, they're quite good. So it's a mix, really. And the second part of the question, the ones that I'm most interested in are the ones that can be influenced by the diet, of course, and body composition. So like testosterone and iron, calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, of course. So yeah, any that can be influenced by the diet, which is pretty much all of them, of course.
For sure. And any pattern or any example of something that you might have picked up in season that you could share in terms of, you know, a biomarker or collection of biomarkers kind of showing you a pattern that you might have then decided certain foods, or whether it's the energy? I mean, just to give an example for some of the practitioners.
I think one with like female athletes has been iron, also some male athletes as well, iron. I think in recent years, obviously, there's been that shift towards plant-based diets and veganism. Maybe not necessarily fully veganism, but like less.
More plant-based, yeah.
Yeah, more plant-based. And that's had an impact upon like circulating iron and ferritin, these things. And that, again, can inform decisions. Like you've got to communicate that back to the player, because otherwise it can seem quite like challenging to them because they've like read perhaps about like the importance of like a plant-based diet and the benefits of a plant-based diet. So they've made this decision to move in this direction. But then if you can provide them with that objective data that it's not necessarily having a beneficial effect on them, or that change needs to be managed,
tweaked or adjusted to.
Yeah. It needs to be adjusted slightly. It can help encourage them and establish that trusting relationship where you can then better help them.
Yeah. It's great when you can actually get a chance, like you say, to sit down and show the results and convey some of the messages and be able to connect it to their goals and what they're trying to achieve, whether it's on the performance or recovery or body composition, or in your example with, you know, plant-based or vegan diet. It's oftentimes athletes will just default to eating less meat and not always inherently eating more vegetables and various other things. And yeah, so that can certainly have an impact on what they're doing.
Yeah. I think one other thing that I'd be really curious about would be like within day energy balance. I know that particularly impacts the female athletes, but like if we can measure biomarkers like frequently enough to see what impact that's having, I think that would be amazing. And also the muscle glycogen, if we could ever like establish a way of objectively measuring muscle glycogen. I know we had that muscle sound thing like 5 years ago perhaps that turned out to be a bit of a mess, but like eventually I'd love for those kind of things as well.
Yeah, to do that without the muscle biopsy would be definitely increase the ability. That'd be tremendous. And Matt, what about, you know, whether it's challenges or lessons learned? Obviously you've been at this for a while, like in elite sport and professional sport. Well, there's some patterns or some stories that you could share around some challenges that you faced and with either in your practice, you know, or within a specific athlete directly.
Yeah, I could probably think of two like that have been like incredibly significant to me as a practitioner. One I've kind of discussed before, and that was the importance of relationships. So I was fortunate enough to go over to the UAE and work with a unit of the military over there. I think I was about 23 or 24, so like very enthusiastic, typical like kind of straight out of university almost, brimming with all these ideas, thinking I could change the world. And I arrived there and it was like complete silence. You could hear like the birds chirping and ordering on the support to me. That's it. For 6 months it kind of lasted, really. It was just like no one really valued nutrition. They didn't really want to
changing their change, life,
they
aren't you?
Really like they were quite comfortable. Easy. Yeah. Exactly. They were quite comfortable in the position they were in, so they didn't really want to change anything or apply any of the ideas that I had. So I had to like think of a way in which I could influence these people. And again, it all started with relationships. So investing time into developing relationships with them. And so in my case, I had to kind of sacrifice myself and go and get involved in their jujitsu sessions. Nice. In the morning. In the UAE or the Middle East, or the UAE particularly, jujitsu is pretty big and it's popular, and especially within the military, it allows them to like progress through the ranks. And I sacrificed myself. I had never done jujitsu before, and it was a learning experience, getting beaten up every day. But the conversations that you have on the mat, obviously they kind of continued on during the day, like during the meal times and like coffees in their office with the offices. And then I was able to establish those relationships and like kind of subtly integrating nutrition into those conversations. And then started to apply some of the ideas that I had and then started to have success. So I think that was a big learning, because it all begins with those relationships. And I think that you can pretty much apply the same thing with an elite sport as well. So like finding a way to like develop a relationship with that key stakeholder, whether it be the head coach. If you see him in the gym every morning on the bike, go and like bike with him and start that conversation, and or whatever it might be. It always starts with those relationships. And I think the second lesson, similar sort of thing. I was fortunate enough to go and work in Brazil, and again in Brazil they just wanted to play football. they really didn't care about food. Like they didn't care like whether
they're pretty good. They figure, hey, it's working for them.
Exactly. Yeah. They just wanted to go and play and enjoy themselves on the pitch. So I had to like shift and change all of my messages to in such a way that would like encourage them or kind of explain to them that the food that they ate can actually allow them to play better and play for longer, so they could like enjoy themselves and express themselves better on the pitch. And also amazing. Simplicity, like the language barrier was difficult. So I had to kind of condense all of the messages down into like a single sentence that's actionable and informative. I think those things like relationships kind of develop your message and deliver your message in a way that's relevant and like important to the athlete that you're working with. Mm-hmm. And then simplicity as well.
Yeah, it's amazing how building trust is so key. And you talk about, you know, obviously authenticity being one, and then showing the vulnerability, like getting on the mat and getting beaten up, obviously is a good, really to integrate yourself into the group is a pretty great way. And then, yeah, really interesting to just see in those environments kind of forcing you to be really succinct and simple and straightforward with what you do. And it is sort of amazing sometimes, isn't it, when that then propels itself to better compliance and outcomes. That was a lot easier than, you know, my initial plan or the initial way I thought about it. And that's, you see that in obviously even in Western settings as well. So that's really cool to hear.
Yeah. I often encourage like people sometimes undervalue like experiences within nutrition, whether that be with like the local football team or like over in the Middle East, or like obviously people see that the pinnacle of like the Premier League or the NBA or the NFL, and they think that if like anywhere outside of that is not really
less than
significant, is like less significant. And in actual fact, like most, if not all of my learning experiences have come from those like lower level spaces, really. And that has really helped shape my practice. I developed more as a practitioner there in those like early stages, like learning, making mistakes, than I have it maybe in the last 2 or 3 years for sure.
Yeah, those different environments, amazing, whether you're dealing with collegiate athletes where compliance can be better, let's call it, or like younger athletes, and it's you just learn so many skills dealing with people, don't you? At the end of the day, it's working with people, and athletes are people too, and it does provide you that breadth of experience to be able to figure out where you're to pick your spots, at the best time. So Matt, listen, I appreciate you carving out, you know, your time today. Where's the best place for people to kind of stay connected with you and keep up with your work?
Yeah. Honestly, I think Twitter, like I was speaking to someone the other day about like how I keep up to date with research and things. And honestly, I think Twitter's like the best place for finding research and communicating, connecting with people. Mm-hmm. I'm on LinkedIn as well, probably a little bit more formal.
For sure. We'll include those notes and, in the show notes as well with some of the papers that we chatted about. And again, Matt, appreciate the time. Best of luck the rest of the way with West Ham, and we'll have to circle back again soon.
Thanks very much, Mark. Enjoyed the conversation. Speak soon.
Thank you for listening to the Performance Nutrition Podcast. You can find the full video interviews on YouTube at the Performance Nutrition Podcast channel. Finally, if you enjoyed the podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe, all that good stuff. Thank you, and see you next time.
The Dr. Bubz Performance Podcast endeavors to provide accurate and helpful information to listeners. These podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Dr. Bubz Performance Podcasts.